Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And in for Adam this week, I'm Angelica Jade Bastian.
How did he get here?
He was all alone in the woods. I couldn't leave him there to die.
You know you're not supposed to go that far.
Is he dead?
No. Not yet. Quick. We need to move him to the porch.
Nicole Kidman in the Sofia Coppola-directed remake of 1971's The Beguiled. The rare Don Siegel-Clint Eastwood movie that seems a perfect fit for Coppola.
I don't know. Kidman as Dirty Harry was a huge missed opportunity.
Maybe. Along with Kidman, the movie stars Kirsten Dunst, Elle Fanning, and Colin Farrell. It's set during the Civil War and sees a wounded Union soldier taken in by the residents of a Virginia girls' school. This week on the show, our review of The Beguiled, which won Coppola the Best Director Prize at Cannes earlier this year. Plus, Angelica and I share our top five Sofia Coppola moments. That and more.
You feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Ahead on Film Spotting.
May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Well, I finally make it back after 2 weeks away, and now Adam's gone for a week. I guess the guy deserves a vacation, too. Filling in for Adam, really excited about this. I'm thrilled to have back Chicago critic Angelica Jade Bastian. Hello, Angelica.
Hello, Josh.
Great to have you back on the show. And you are, as our regular listeners probably remember from, I think it was last summer when you were on, you're a contributing writer at Vulture, but you've also written for many other places, the New York Times, the Village Voice, the Atlantic, and Refinery 29. Now, last time when you were in the show, I'm afraid we stuck you with a review of Suicide Squad. Oh, wasn't quite fair, but more happily, we were able to share our top five women comic book characters done right, and you had Wonder Woman, the animated version voiced by Kerry Russell. She was on your list. So before we get too far into the show here, I have to ask, how did you like this summer's Wonder Woman?
Such a loaded question, Josh.
And this isn't the whole show, so yeah. We got to keep this brief.
Well, I'm a huge Wonder Woman fan, and I will say overall, as someone who has been waiting for this film since I was a little girl, I was very pleased with it, except for that last act, which felt cut from a completely different, more boring superhero film.
But overall,
I liked it.
Sounds like we're somewhat similar in where we landed on the film. So good. I'm glad you weren't disappointed. I would have felt terrible about that. Wonder Woman, of course, was made by a female director, Patty Jenkins. And we have another female-helmed feature to consider this week, Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled. We're also going to share our top five Sofia Coppola moments later in the show. First, though, let's get to that Beguiled review. The last time Coppola went into the distant past, she had I Want Candy playing in Versailles. What does she bring to Civil War-era Virginia?
You're a most unwelcome visitor, and we do not propose to entertain you.
You'll find them easily amused.
You won't be here long enough for that.
How did you end up in this place?
Why are you so interested in me?
I admire your strength.
I'm just trying to give them what they need to survive in these times.
If you could have anything in the world, what would it be?
To be taken far away from here.
Come with me.
He seems to be a sensitive person.
Does he?
Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled is just opening this weekend here in Chicago, Angelica, but it's already had quite the journey. First came its May triumph at Cannes, where Coppola won the Best Director award, and friend of the show David Ehrlich called it the mustiest and most conventionally entertaining film of Coppola's brilliant career. That praise was followed by a bit of a backlash leading up to its stateside release, including a Slate piece by former Film Spotting Advisory Board member Corey Attad, criticizing the film for ignoring the historical reality of slavery. This all seems to be par for the course for Coppola, who has long had both ardent fans and equally ardent detractors. So I'm curious where you stand on her as a filmmaker, Angelica. Is her work overrated or underrated, or is it simply understandably divisive? And where does The Beguiled, in which a wounded Union soldier recuperates as a prisoner slash patient in a Southern girls' boarding school, come into that equation for you?
Overall, I think Sofia Coppola has one of the most distinctive voices of a young-ish modern director. I think she's really fascinating, especially her approach to white womanhood and her obsession with femininity and girlhood and that sort of stage in a young woman's life between being a girl and a woman. And I think that's really fascinating. And I appreciate her voice and her aesthetics. And I always feel like I'm really brought into a swooning romantic world, even if the ideas themselves aren't romantic. I think she has a very romantic perspective, and I appreciate that. Overall, I've never been fully enamored with her work, but The Beguiled really had me under its spell. Very interested in that. And I think part of it was because I could totally tell it was filmed in Louisiana.
Okay. And even though set in Virginia, yeah. But yes.
Yeah. When I saw that set in Virginia and I was watching the film, I cackled to myself. I was like, this is Louisiana.
Because you're from there, right? Or have family?
My mother's family and my mom, they're from Lauraville, Louisiana.
Okay.
And so when I say I'm going home, what I'm really telling people I'm spending time between New Orleans and Lauraville.
Okay.
I'm from Miami, though.
Got it. So how did that inform your experience of the film then? You didn't find that jarring that this is, you know, obviously? Because I feel like her movies, you're right, obviously Marie Antoinette and The Beguiled even more so. It's set in, what is it, 1864 Virginia, mm-hmm. I think, but it's really not. It's set in Coppola land, that place you were describing, which I would agree with. It's this mood, this experience of a certain time in life, a very particular perspective. It's a certain temperament that she captures more so than any particular time and place. So for me, I don't find these historical anomalies jarring, or even anomalies in terms of place jarring. It seems to work for whatever she needs to create that mood that she's going for. Was it something similar for you?
Yeah, I agree. And I think for me also, I don't go to film for realism, historical or otherwise. I go for emotional truths. So as long as I feel the characters have a strong sense of self and I can buy how they look at the world, because that's what I think Coppola does really well. These aren't supposed to be slices of a time and a place that we know of and have read in history books necessarily, but it's looking at these worlds through the eyes of these young women. I completely buy how she frames things because of that.
Yeah. So for me, you're essentially getting a similar perspective that you would in, what was it, 1970s suburbia mm-hmm. from the Virgin Suicides, that you would get in the France of Marie Antoinette, that you're getting here in the Civil War era of The Beguiled. And that's not to say that this perspective is repetitive. Mm-hmm. I really liked The Beguiled. It's up there at the top of her films for me, and it's because I do see it as something of an advancement on these sorts of characters she's mm-hmm. been interested in and fleshing them out, especially looking back for our top five as I did on a lot of scenes of The Virgin Suicides, which I do like. But this movie is much more particular about the individual experiences going on among these young girls and women at this school, whereas The Virgin Suicides was a little bit more – those sisters were all kind of one being in a sense.
Yeah, which is interesting.
It is interesting. And I think that's probably what she meant to do, is
make it
sort of a communal consideration. But there is a progression here where, you know, you understand, or at least I did, the particular desires that – the movie is all about desire mm-hmm. for me. Beguiled. But it's not just this communal or maybe ethereal desire. It's something very specific for Nicole Kidman's headmistress, where she is – there's the great sponge bath scene where she kind of comes alive there while Colin Farrell is recuperating. But it's not just sexual for her. There's also this notion of companionship.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you look at someone like Kirsten Dunst's teacher, and she almost has this desire for a different social status. She's stuck here in this place. And so John McDerney, the soldier played by Farrell, represents that promise to her of having a different life. That's her desire.
Yeah.
And then you have Elle Fanning, who is, you know, just, she's just alive, right?
Yeah.
She's young and alive. Yes, there's a sexual component to it as well. But for me, it was almost more that she stood out as one of the few girls there who had her own inner life, and it wasn't until he arrived that she let that loose, you know? I loved how she would just hang over a chair so, like, lazily and unconcerned. Or one of my favorite moments is when she's raking out in the yard and can barely manage to pull the rake across the ground because she doesn't want to be there. When he comes around, she comes to life. So that's a different sort of desire. Hers is almost for adulthood that she's longing for, and he represents a step towards that. So all of that is to say, for me, the film was a much richer consideration of character, even though it uses – Coppola used the same tools she always does to express that character. And I appreciated that quite a bit about the film.
Oh, I definitely agree. It was also nice to see Coppola sort of turn her focus onto a woman that is a little bit older.
Yeah,
she tends to focus really on girls or girlish women who are still really young. So it was really fascinating to kind of see the sort of age dynamics that happened between Nicole Kidman, Kirsten Dunst, and Elle Fanning. It's like different chapters in a woman's life, and where your currency is completely different, where your values are different, where your desires are really different. I did interpret Elle Fanning's character very differently than you did, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, with Elle Fanning and the raking scene, I did think a lot about privilege and the loss of privilege and innocence in a way.
Okay.
And so I think that Colin Farrell's character is almost like a blank slate she can project her desires on as a girl who's not even sure what womanhood means. And so she's kind of playing around with that. And she needs him to be sort of a passive figure, which is why I think she came to kiss him when he was basically asleep.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like that. That makes sense. And it also brings to mind the character that Farrell plays in general, you said, is a blank slate. And I think he does play his charms. You know, he's not completely uninvolved here.
Oh, no.
But it's really more as a survival tool. There's an interesting distinction for me from the 71 version, which I was able to watch, where Eastwood was much more wolfish to me.
And scuzzy.
And scuzzy, yeah. And I think that's because that movie was more worried about the male threat, and this movie is more concerned with the nature of the feminine desire. That's the priority. And so really what you need then from the Farrell performance is, sure, an element of danger is there. And again, he is charming because there has to be something that they're drawn to, and he's handsome. But really it is what they're going to project onto him, what he represents for each of them. So it's an interesting and clever performance by Farrell by having to walk that line where he needs to be this object of desire, but not take over the movie, but still be at the service of all the other performances. And I think he manages to balance that. But what did you think of his performance?
I actually think Colin Farrell is really fascinating because he's one of the few actors working today who is, one, really good actor, and two, is very beautiful and understands the dynamics of being an object of desire as a man and how different that is. And to being passive isn't exactly the right word, but sort of being guided by the desires of everybody else around you.
Yeah,
and he's really, his interaction with the camera is really fascinating to me. And I sort of kept thinking about Elizabeth Taylor, partially because they did have a literal relationship at the end of her life, which I need to know what her game was because
this is the first I'm hearing about any of this.
Oh, look it up. He had an interview on Ellen about it.
And okay.
I was so shocked and amazed and in awe of Elizabeth Taylor, as I always am. But he sort of smolders in a way that I find really fascinating.
Well, in all my travels, I've never come across such a delicate beauty as yours. Tell me something, will you? Miss Morrow, it's okay. If you could have anything, what's your biggest wish? If you could have anything in the world, what would it be?
Anything.
Yeah, anything.
To be taken far away from me.
It's like he adjusts his performance, and he's sort of, the best way I can put it is he reminds me of a really good con artist, where he adjusts his performance depending on his audience. He's a man at home anywhere in the world, is the way I would kind of put it. It's really fascinating just seeing how he molds to what the women want. So when he's with Nicole Kidman, he asks, you know, her if she had a companion before the war and admires her strength and her steeliness.
Yeah.
With Kirsten Dunst, he becomes the knight in shining armor that she so greatly desires. For Elle Fanning, he becomes sort of like a schoolyard crush, and he's sweet. And he's approachable. And then with the younger girls, he's almost like an older brother.
Yeah, that's what I was going to add. The youngest, Amy, who first discovers him in the woods, I especially like Una Lawrence is the actress there. I especially like how he's her buddy, right? It's how he physically deals with them as well, because I think he kind of taps her on the shoulder or nudges her. You know, these little like buddy movements compared to the ones that the ways he treats even physically the other girls and the women. You make me think of his performance in The Lobster too.
Oh, definitely.
Where he's willing to put his physical features at the service of what that movie needs.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he's got the gut and he's kind of this schlub a little bit, but still has a certain appeal to some of the women that he meets there. So yeah, I think Ferrell is really going through a rich phase of his career right now, and he does add a lot to The Beguiled. I think it's a great showcase for Nicole Kidman, someone who I honestly, I wouldn't say written off, but maybe was not as excited in recent years about performances of hers as maybe I should have been, because she uses some of her tools here as well to, you know, that iciness is a word you hear a lot attributed to her, and a certain remove. And she certainly has that here as the woman who's in control of this school. But the way she opens those cracks, the scene we talked about with the sponge bath and she has to, you know, splash water on her face, opens those cracks to let us see the woman inside. And again, the desires that are going on within her. So you mentioned the Elle Fanning raking scene and how the connection there with privilege, and maybe that's a good place to return to the criticism the film has received that Coria Todd wrote about for Slate and other critics have mentioned as well. Privilege is a phrase that has been thrown at a lot of Coppola's films. Here in particular, the concern had been that there's a line early on about the slaves ran away or went away, and that is the only acknowledgement that slavery even existed in this time period in American history. Now, it's interesting to me, having watched the 71 version, because that's much more interwoven into the narrative where there's a slave character.
Mm-hmm.
And again, while that film, I think, is very interested in different things about this scenario, and she is also seen as a victim or potential victim of male threat, because I think that's what that movie is about, at least there's that presence there. There isn't that presence at all in Coppola's The Beguiled. She's getting a lot of heat for it. How'd you take that?
So I have a lot to say about this subject matter, especially as a black woman from the South, where even if black people aren't around, we're still apparent. And so I have a lot of issues with the criticism about race that have sort of swelled up around the movie very quickly, sometimes from people who hadn't even seen it, but were just offended by the lack of at least one black character.
Yeah.
And I actually had a lot of problems with that Slate piece and some other things Corey has said about The Beguiled. But I kept, you know, my mouth shut because I was like, let me actually see the movie.
Sure, of course.
Before I jump to any conclusion, which is something I kept seeing people do. And
so what did the movie give you? When you saw the movie, what did you take away from it as far as this is concerned?
I think it is heavily myopic to say that race is not apparent in this movie just because there isn't a black character. Because I think being from the South, being a black woman who has walked by plantations I can assume my ancestors have worked on, black people are always there in this country even if we're not there because we have built these buildings. The fact that the garden was in complete disarray to me was one of the signs that they do not have their usual help.
I see. Okay.
The fact that they didn't have their hoop skirts. There's, you know, certain things that were missing from their usual rituals because there was a lack of a black person to do it for them, specifically a black woman. So the in a way, that absence becomes a weird commentary in and of itself about the ways that white women insulate themselves from their privilege and blind them from their privilege. And so there's two things to note with this. I think, one, in a culture that's so obsessed with auteur theory, we're going to, of course, look at the director and their intent, I think sometimes a little bit more than we should. Because watching the film, Sofia Coppola may have wanted to create a movie about the interior lives of young and older women in Civil War South Virginia, although I was about to slip up and call it Louisiana. But to me, the movie came across as an indictment of the way white women insulate themselves and the fantasies that people believe about the old South.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of hear it when there's this moment where Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell are talking after one of these dinners they have, and she gets wistful talking about how beautiful the house used to be and all the women dressed up. And in a weird way, this film seems like a time capsule for that sort of loss of desire of this specific time period and what it offered those women. Of course, a movie so obsessed with their perspectives of themselves and seeing themselves as the hero of their own story would not have a black woman in it.
Yeah.
That breaks the fantasy.
So you're talking about a level of self-critique that you found there. I think I would agree that there's more of that in The Beguiled than it's been given credit for. Now,
I don't think Coppola's aware, though.
That's exactly where I was going, because I, you know, as much as I love auteur theory and participate in it myself, I think there are limitations. And this may be one of those cases. I do think there's another progression here, though, from something like The Virgin Suicides and even Lost in Translation, which I like and I think is her best film. But I don't think that movie is as self-aware as certain elements of The Beguiled
is.
Now, I'm not saying that this is some sort of personal growth on the part of Coppola, but for whatever reason, whether it's the collaborators or just life experience or the story she's chosen to tell, I think there is a growing level of self awareness slash critique about this interior state of young womanhood that she is so obsessed about. And you mentioned the word myopia or myopic, and that's how I describe her films as well, but not necessarily negatively. You absolutely cannot deny that these are myopic films. Their lens is so narrow.
I agree.
And while there are limitations to that, I think the line about slavery is clumsy in The Beguiled. I think some of the concerns that have been expressed are valid. But at the same time, and, you know, think about something like Marie Antoinette, where the French Revolution is off screen. I mean, there's something unfortunate about that. But at the same time, this narrow lens that she creates with her films gets me in the moment, in a sensual instant, in a way that few filmmakers do. And it's because she's not worried about anything else going on. She's worried about the temperature in the air. She's worried about the taste of the food that they're eating.
Texture.
The texture of the clothes that they're wearing, the music maybe they're listening to or is playing in their heads. And that requires a distinct, narrow focus to make us feel like we're there as well. And so it's a give and take. I think it's, you know, maybe a difficulty of her personal style. But at the same time, if you took that away and asked her to make a more expansive vision of this era, we would get something a little more generic, and we wouldn't get something as particular and as of the moment as The Beguiled was, at least for me, as a film experience.
Yeah, I want to make two or three other points. One, yes, I don't think Coppola was cognizant of the fact that she tripped into a very interesting critique of white womanhood by not having slave characters and having it be so insular and myopic, which I don't mean that as an insult either.
That's okay, right?
Yeah.
It's okay if a movie becomes its own thing and reveals things that maybe the filmmakers didn't intend.
Exactly.
And that's probably the case here, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's why we need to be careful with this obsession with using auteur theory as a lens for criticism so consistently and taking what directors say. Because if I did that, I would never watch classic film because so many of those directors were racist and did not, you know, there was no presence of a black woman like me in them. Ira Madison, the III, wrote for The Daily Beast a really interesting piece that critiqued Sofia Coppola's myopic stance as a director while also acknowledging that she should not be doing a film that deals with black characters.
Right,
in
that's
this
the
setting.
Other thing. Would you really want that?
No. You know what? We should be championing for women of color to have
make
the,
that movie.
Exactly. And then my third point is, you can make a movie that's incisive about race without having any people of color present. If anything, I think more white directors and white writers need to indict whiteness. And I think there's this idea that race discussions can only be a present when there's a person of color present. And I think one of the problems is whiteness has gone by unpoliced and treated as sort of the baseline and never questioned and never really talked about or interrogated. But I think there's an opportunity to really do that. That's something I'm really interested in doing. And it's actually weirdly something I was thinking about watching Baby Driver and John Hamm's performance.
Oh, okay. I'm jealous. I haven't seen it yet. So maybe we'll get into that a little bit later in the show when that comes up with our poll question. Another element of The Beguiled I wanted to ask you about, though, and we'll have to dance a little bit around spoilers here, is the shift it takes from what I would say psychological drama to psychological horror. I took it that way. How did you take that shift? Do you think that worked? Because that, for me, speaking of Coppola and as an auteur, was different material for her that she hasn't really dealt with before. Do you think she handled it as well as this more familiar terrain?
I definitely think she handled it really well. To me, first and foremost, The Beguiled is a Southern Gothic. Gothic can
Makes
have
sense.
Elements of horror and the grotesque, which is what I think the film does surprisingly well, especially for someone so interested in beauty. So I think there was this really interesting juxtaposition between these somewhat grotesque moments, sometimes bloody moments, sometimes harrowing moments, and then these moments of these young women getting together for dinner and like putting on their corsets and putting on ribbons as bracelets because they don't have jewelry. Very, very, very dynamic sense of tension, very vivid.
Yeah, and there's some dark humor there as well.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I liked how she paired off the obsession with beauty at the start when it's more of a psychological drama. And then makes it – she like twists it and curdles it when it becomes something more horror. So take, for example, the frequent insert shots we get at the beginning of the young girls learning embroidery. So this is a thing of beauty. And then increasingly stitching becomes more associated with wounds and let's just say worse.
Yeah.
So I like how she twists that. The dinners you mentioned early on, they try to impress him by sitting down for a fancy dinner and they're all dolled up. And then let's say another later dinner is echoed, but they look more like they're attending a funeral wake or something like that.
Very somber.
And so it's almost as if when I think that turn works for her because she doesn't completely negate these other concerns that the earlier portions of the film had or her other pictures have had, but uses a way again to curdle them and twist them to the direction that The Beguiled is taking.
I do want to say that I think it's amazing the way Kirsten Dunst and Sofia Coppola collaborate.
Yeah.
And I think they're one of the great examples of star-director dynamics in the modern age because they've worked together for such a long time through different chapters of each of their lives. And there's a really good interview with Coppola at the Village Voice that sort of talks about that and how they have shorthand. And I think this is such a textured and beautiful and sort of wounded performance from Kirsten Dunst.
That's a good word for it. And it's different, really, than what we've seen her do for Coppola before, right? She was quite memorably the Elle Fanning part, you could say, in
exactly.
The Virgin Suicides. Obviously, there are variations on what they're doing there. But yeah, here she is the reticent one, Yeah, wounded is the right word, and it's not what I think of as a Kirsten Dunst performance. It's reserved in different ways and also quite good. I think everyone is really good across the board in this cast. And again, for the various tones that they're trying to hit and the shift in those tones, I think that is another impressive element of The Beguiled. All right, so two favorable opinions here on The Beguiled. It is currently in limited release. We want to hear your take on it, of course. So if you've seen it, whether or not you agree or disagree with us, send those thoughts to feedback@filmspotting.net. All right, the Film Spotting Top 5 is next, and I wore my anachronistic Chuck Taylor All-Stars for the occasion. It's our favorite Sofia Coppola moments when we come back. Stay with us.
Oh, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
My driver for every job since we met. You're the best in the business. I'm gonna need you behind the wheel again.
One more job and I'm done.
One more job and we're straight.
That's from Edgar Wright's Baby Driver, which opened earlier this week and is, according to Metacritic anyway, the best reviewed wide release of 2017. Adam and I are going to get to a review of that next week. I have yet to see it. Angelica, you have, and you're a fan?
I am a bigger fan than I expected. I really enjoyed it.
Because you're a fan of Edgar Wright as well, or?
Not really.
Not really, okay.
Sorry, Edgar Wright fans. I find him enjoyable, but I have never had the desire to rewatch any of his films.
Okay.
They're cute, is how I like to put it.
Oh, man. Cute. Now you didn't have to anger Edgar Wright fans by saying that. But Baby Driver, though.
A lot of fun.
Okay.
And I was not expecting to dig it, but it's so propulsive and has so much energy, and it's such fluid camera work, and it's just a really fun ride.
Sounds great. I can't wait to check it out, and then Adam and I will talk about it next week. Baby Driver, as I said, the top-rated wide release of 2017. Adam and I are going to take a look at the year so far in a couple of weeks. We'll have a little bit more on how and where we're going to do that in just a bit. But in anticipation of that top five, the top five films of 2017 so far, we want to know what you think is the best of the year at this point with our new poll question. Here are the options we're going to give you. The best film of 2017 so far is
Baby Driver, The Beguiled, Get Out, Logan, The Lost City of Z, Personal Shopper, Wonder Woman, or
Other. We'll let you choose Other if your favorite film of the year so far is not on this list. Angelica, is your favorite film of 2017 so far on this list?
I don't think I have one yet, honestly.
You haven't had a top five facing you that you have to make this decision,
so
huh?
So daunting. I hate top fives.
All right. Well, you did tease that, and we can't get into it now, even though I'd really love to. You're not a huge fan of Get Out. I don't know anyone who's not a huge fan of Get Out. So just tell me this. Can we find like a review of it, or did you write about this anywhere?
Nope. I have not written a bit, because to say I don't only dislike Get Out, I actually actively hate the film and find the idea that it's trenchantly discussing race laughable.
All right, put that down on paper or on digital somewhere so that I can read it, because I do like to read the contrary opinions. We're going to move on for now, though. Looking ahead at that best of the year so far list, Adam and I are going to put together. The show won't post until July 21, but that's because we're going to record that top five live. And only 3.5 hours from Chicago. So Chicago listeners, come on, show your loyalty. Drive on out. It's going to be our first live show outside of Chicago. No, not New York, not LA, not Austin, not Minneapolis, but Spring Green, Wisconsin. This is about an hour west of Madison. The population, 1,600. They've been clamoring for a film spotting live show. Actually, this is the home of producer Sam Van Halgren, and also the home of a fantastic independent bookstore, Arcadia Books. I've been there the last few summers, a favorite spot with my family. So we are heading there to record this show on Sunday, July 16. I'm also going to be doing a promotional gig there for my new book, Movies Are Prayers, which is out now. So we'll do a little bit of a book talk probably before the live recording, and then we'll do our top five list there right in the bookstore. This is Sunday, July 16, 2 p.m. is when things are going to get started there. It's open to the public, but again, this is a small independent bookstore, so space is limited. If you want some more details about all of that, you can go to the events page at filmspotting.net. Okay, Angelica, your favorite part of the show. I know this is why you agree to come on Film Spotting. Massacre Theater. Should we do it? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
That's exactly the right attitude for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and then listeners get a chance at winning a prize. A couple of weeks back, Adam and I massacred this scene.
I found this here by the statue.
That is a likeness of the goddess of love. It's very remarkable. A sword, eh?
Yes. But this is no ordinary sword.
Well, it's a strange metal. It's neither brass nor iron. It's like no metal that I have ever seen. By the gods.
There's a shield. And over there's a helmet.
I was right to say it, by the gods. Who else could make a sword that slices through solid marble without leaving the slightest blemish on the blade?
If the sword can do that, then what about the helmet and the shield?
That was Harry Hamlin and Burgess Meredith in 1981's Clash of the Titans. It was written by Beverly Cross, directed by Desmond Davis. We did that scene during our show that also included a review of Wonder Woman and our top five religious experiences at the movies. As for the tie-ins, recent Massacre Theater winner Jay Becker had those. The tie-in, of course, he said, Greek mythology, which has a strong presence in both Clash and Wonder Woman. We got a lot of incorrect entries for
really?
This Massacre Theater performance. You think it would have been obvious, but I think, and yes, this shows what happened. A lot of people suggested we were doing Wayne's World. I made probably the incorrect choice of a schwing sound for the sword clanging the marble. I thought it was true to the text when I watched the scene and heard it. That's what I heard. Schwing! But it threw listeners off. So sorry to you Wayne's World fans who entered Massacre Theater that way. We did get many, many correct entries as well, including our winner, Angelica. Reach into the film spotting hat, and who do you have there as our winner?
Our winner is Glenn Graff from Buffalo Grove, Illinois.
Congratulations, Glenn. Email us at feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with your prize. Okay, let's do it. Let's get to this week's Massacre Theater.
Camera, mite. Camera, 目線で. Yukkuri to. Ne, passion. Camera, 目には.
My side.
Passion, da. Wakatta?
And with intensity.
Is that everything? I mean, it seemed like he said quite a bit more than that.
It is very gracious of you to play along with our silly reindeer games here, Angelica. It was fun last time. I'm sure this will be fun as well. There are tie-ins, some pretty obvious ones in the text itself to The Beguiled. Love it when listeners find more, so can't wait to hear those. I am going to get things started here, so I need the action cue from you. Give me a moment to get into character. And then let it roll.
And action.
Hey, wake up, you. There's troops coming.
Blue or gray?
They gray like us. Let's say hello to them and then get going. Hurrah! Hurrah for the Confederacy! Hurrah! Down with General Grant! Hurrah for General... What's the name?
Lee.
Lee. Lee! Lee! Ha! Yeah! God is with us because he hates the Yanks, too! Hurrah!
God's not on our side because he hates idiots also.
And scene. Now, you told me you were going to channel someone else. Were you doing it there?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Then, since you were channeling someone else as this prominent actor you were playing, if listeners can guess correctly, not only who you were playing, but also who you were channeling, I don't know, they'll have to get an extra film spotting t-shirt or something.
I highly doubt anyone will be able to figure this out. But can I give them a hint?
Yeah, go for it.
A very, very, very small hint. The show that I'm channeling a character from is based in my hometown that I mentioned earlier.
Okay,
if
there you go.
If you guys are really listening.
Get on it. Get on it, film spotting listeners. If you know that, or if you just know the film we massacred.
Also, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Also, if you just follow me on Twitter, you probably have heard me talking about this show a lot because I've been rewatching it.
All right. Hints galore there. So you should be able to figure this out. At the very least, if you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Our deadline this time is Monday, July 10.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
So what are you doing here?
A couple of things.
taking a break from my wife, forgetting my son's birthday, and getting paid $2 million to endorse a whiskey when I could be doing a play somewhere.
Oh.
But the good news is the whiskey works.
Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray, you just heard in 2003's Lost in Translation. Nearly 15 years later, a movie that still looms large over the rest of Sofia Coppola's filmography. Before we get to our top five Coppola scenes, Angelica, let's see just how large it looms. A couple weeks back, we asked you to name Coppola's best film. We gave listeners two options. They could pick Lost in Translation or Other, any other. So it includes The Virgin Suicides, Marie Antoinette, Somewhere, and The Bling Ring, and of course, The Beguiled, if some listeners have been able to see that already. And the results, this was a pounding. Other, only 26% of the vote. Lost in Translation received 74% of the vote. I probably could have guessed that it would have won. Does it surprise you that it was that easy of a win?
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, it's the one people talk about. It's the one they remember. In my mind, I do think that it is her best film. We got some feedback to this poll, the one-sided poll. Eddie in Reseda, California just said, I want to rob. The Bling Ring is one of the best movies of the decade so far. You were just asking between recording, Angelica, if people really like The Bling Ring. Eddie likes it quite a bit. We also heard from Michelle Foy.
And Michelle Foy wrote in Marie Antoinette. She says, not just my favorite of Coppola's, but also her best, most masterfully crafted film. I remember seeing a published version of the script for Marie Antoinette in a bookstore once and saw that the ending initially had a note along the lines of fade to black as the sound of the guillotine dropping echoes. I am so glad Coppola never actually followed through with that choice. What makes Coppola such a unique and satisfying filmmaker for me are her patience and keen eye for elegant yet effortless stylistic choices, and nowhere have those been better expressed than in Marie Antoinette.
And another vote here for an other film. Michael Locher in El Cerrito, California chose Somewhere. Lost in Translation, he says, is a lovely, sophisticated film, and I completely understand why it's generally Coppola's most admired. The one I've seen the most is the effervescent, witty, and altogether terrific Marie Antoinette. But unless The Beguiled blows me away, I'll likely go to my grave defending Somewhere. Something of a disregarded stepchild for many, but in my estimation, a total gem. Coppola has a wonderful knack for observing the emotional lives of her characters, but she also favors a mannered style that creates a hypnotic distance. If the stylish Translation and Antoinette feel a little impersonal at times, the understated Somewhere is overflowing with humanity. It's the director's most intimate film. Stephen Dorff's character might be a Hollywood actor who whisks his daughter from the Chateau Marmont to Milan, but with his spotty grooming, his social awkwardness, his busted arm, and his fundamental lack of charisma, he's immediately human and a little pitiable. The people in Sofia Coppola's films often seem transfixed as life passes them by. Here, however, is a curveball. Johnny Marco, bored and boring, sets down his privileged cocktail to simply enjoy time with his kid, and I find it honest and emotionally engaging as hell. I admire the dramatic arc and exotic art-directed veil of Coppola's other projects, but I wish she'd make more pictures like Somewhere. Well, let's find out, Angelica, if Somewhere lands a spot on either of our top five lists as we get into our top five Sofia Coppola scenes. Now, I know we should probably say at the start here that you found this a little challenging because as you revisit some other films, you weren't as enamored with them as maybe you were in your memory, or were there any of these you watched for the first time for this list? How'd you go about forming this list?
Well, overall with Coppola, I find her a very intriguing director, but I've never been really obsessed or taken by her work.
Okay.
What surprised me was how much I forgot from these movies.
Huh.
So I rewatched Marie Antoinette, and there's certain details I just started to pick up on that I found really fascinating, especially after watching The Beguiled and seeing how obsessed she is with rituals of femininity. Really fascinating. So a lot of my list picks up on moments that hone in on that.
Sounds great. Let's jump right into it. What did you put at number five?
So at number five is from The Virgin Suicides. It's about a half hour into the movie when Josh Hartnett, with that ridiculous wig, walks into the school, his jacket flung over his shoulder, and all the women are looking at him. And what intrigues me about that moment is just how it's representative of Coppola's obsession with how women look at the world and how they kind of project their desires onto different figures. And he's a very obvious object of desire in The Virgin Suicides.
Yeah, and as I remember it, it's an extended montage, really, doesn't it? Follow him laying in his pool.
Yep.
And then a girl brings homework and brownies. Yeah, is that part of this scene?
Yeah, this girl brings brownies, and he has his like towel slung very, very, very low.
That's right, yes.
I was like, they do that in high school? Did I miss something?
And the use of music, too. I forget what exactly the song is in that scene.
Imagine
but that's it. That's right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so definitely a trait of hers, how she weaves all of that together. So good pick from The Virgin Suicides. That's where I'm going to start as well with my number five, but with a different scene, the homecoming dance. Mm. Now, as a reminder, this is the movie that it was Coppola's debut, and it's about five sheltered sisters who become this object of group object of fascination for the boys in their 70s suburban neighborhood, and even more so after the youngest sister commits suicide. So this is a rare moment, this homecoming dance scene that I'm picking, where the girls are let out of the house by their parents to the homecoming dance, no less, of all places, to let them go. And the sister, played by Kirsten Dunst, is announced as the homecoming queen. And it's as if these girls come to life for the first time. And they're a little unsure of themselves earlier in the sequence, but when she's announced and they're kind of like accepted into this social gathering, they just come to life. And Coppola perfectly captures that sort of effervescence that you would feel. So it's the music that we were just talking about that's coming into play here, the lighting, the use of props, the balloons that come down from the ceiling, how the characters interact with them. All of that really combines, and it captures, as I was saying in our Beguiled review, sometimes what she does best is just a singular mood. Mm-hmm. And to me, this scene is elation, you know, elation that these girls are feeling. So we're both starting our lists with the beginning of Coppola's career. Yeah. The Virgin Suicides. Which way are you going to go for your number four?
I'm actually going to choose something from The Beguiled.
Fair enough.
Not a spoiler, but sort of harkens to this idea of ritualism through femininity. And there's two really interesting dinner scenes. I won't spoil it for you guys. Don't worry. What's most interesting to me is what happens right before each of those dinner scenes and how the women get ready. And young girls. And seeing them lace up their corsets, putting pieces of fabric and ribbon around their wrists, trying to basically ape what they think of as being a woman and how it changes over the course of the film when we have the second dinner scene. It's just really beautiful mirroring of growth for these women. And I thought it was just really fascinating. And I just really love the ritual of getting ready myself. And I think it's amazing that Coppola is so interested in the interior lives of women. She hones in on these very small details with care and without condescension. She thinks that girlhood is as worthy of study as anything else. And I think that's what I really love about her. And rewatching the films, I liked moments like that from her work.
So I'm right there with you. I have The Beguiled at number four, and I went with the exact same scene, actually, because it's incorporating, as you said, all of these things she's always been interested in, but how it would play out not only in this specific setting, but to these individual characters. This is an ensemble scene, but we get a sense of how each of them are experiencing it exactly through what you talked about, what they're wearing, what they're eating. I wrote in my review of The Beguiled how if you want to know how a Coppola character is feeling, don't listen to what they're saying. You don't get any exposition about them. Watch what they're wearing and watch what they're eating. And usually that is going to tell you. That's how they express themselves, and their inner lives are in those things, which sounds reductionistic, but that's how we all are. I mean, and that's the sort of detail that cinema can capture. So I think it absolutely comes to the fore here in this dinner scene where McBurney, the Colin Farrell character, joins them. They look like overripe Easter eggs in some of these dresses that they wear. It's just so overdone. And I like how they make a fuss over the lavish spread on the table, too.
Oh, yes.
Isn't this the scene where one of them, it might be Kirsten Dunst's character, is sure to point out that it's her recipe that was used.
Yes. Yeah. That moment, that first dinner scene, has a lot of really sharp humor. And it specifically feels like the kind of humor I'm used to hearing from Southern women who say, bless your heart.
Okay.
And it's very specific how they're kind of jockeying for his attention by mentioning all the labor they put into it. It's my recipe. I picked the apples.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's more the fight between these actual girls and women that's interesting than Colin Farrell himself, who is delighted, though, and is just like,
sure,
cracking up.
Literally right eating it up. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's true. It's kind of a passive aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. And there's a shift there, too, where the women and girls start to turn against each other. And then the movie turns where they go a different direction.
Yes.
All right. We'll leave that there. How about your number three Coppola moment?
So my number three comes from Marie Antoinette. And there's a lot of really great moments and images from this film. So it was really hard to pick one. But again, I think because of watching The Beguiled really recently, I'm kind of obsessed with how these characters dress and how they're clothed. And there's a moment a scene really early in Marie Antoinette when she's traveling from Austria to France and she has to go through that sort of tent fixture. She has to take off everything she's wearing, everything that's a sign of her past life in Austria, to become a sort of girl woman. She's not really a woman yet, but it's a very sharp change in how she dresses, even how she stands and presents herself. And the moment when she kind of walks out on the side of France in this beautiful blue dress, I was just like, I don't know, I was just really taken by it. And just the change in Kirsten Dunst's posture because of just wearing just a more elaborate, different gown with all these different fixtures to keep her in place. It was just really, I think, beautiful depiction of how clothing can affect identity.
Sure. Yeah, another instance of costuming projecting inner life or at least inner experience.
Oh, definitely.
That I considered, too, for a scene from Marie Antoinette. I'm going to go with a different film, though, for my number three. It comes from The Bling Ring, and it's the long-distance robbery. So this movie's from 2013. It's based on the true story of a group of California teens who burglarized a string of celebrity homes around LA, and this was about 2009, I think, when this was happening. So a lot of these robberies are what you'd probably expect. They're Coppola parties. They're celebratory. Mm-hmm. They're putting us in that ecstatic mood of these young people who have pulled off these robberies and are sometimes trying on the celebrities' clothes, basically being them for mm-hmm. a few moments. And it puts us in that experience the way yeah. she can do so well. But then there's this scene, which is completely different. It's a long, slow zoom to depict the robbery of Audrina Partridge's house. It begins really far away. It's like a distant establishing shot, and we can see these two figures just slipping into the house, and we slowly, slowly, really slowly zoom in. Like one of these zooms where you hardly notice it until you realize, oh, the house is now filling the frame. But that's as close as we get. Mm-hmm. By that point, they've rifled through all the rooms, and they're making their way out, and the scene ends there.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting about this one is that it's such an anomaly for Coppola. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a moment of detachment when I usually experience that we're completely in the moment with her characters. We're right there alongside them. And this just stands apart where it's observational, it's removed. The characters as a result come across as little furtive. They're even insignificant. So I don't know why. You know, I probably need to spend more time thinking about why at this point – or in this movie, she wants to distance her camera from those characters. Like what's being said there? We talked in our Beguiled review about, is there some sort of self-awareness in her, maybe not in her as a person, but her as a filmmaker, in her films growing? Is The Beguiled a turning point there where we're starting to take a step back from those moment-to-moment experiences? But for whatever reason, it's a really remarkable moment in her films that stands apart for being so different from the other ones.
Oh, I definitely agree, especially because I think Coppola's defining feature as a director is her intimacy.
Mm.
So to have a moment like that completely like...
Yeah, not intimate at all, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
clinical
it's
almost.
Clinical is, yeah, that makes sense. And it's almost as it's depicting an invasion of intimacy, too, mm-hmm. is interesting. So, yeah, maybe there's something there. So that gets us to our number two picks. What did you have for your number two Coppola moment?
Oh, this was so hard. So I'm going to choose just a line from The Virgin Suicides.
Fair enough.
Where, you know, like the older Trip Fontaine, originally played by Josh Hartnett, like they're doing the interviews, like about how they felt about these girls. And he describes Lux, Kirsten Dunst's character, as a still point in a turning world. And I think that can be used to describe pretty much every female character in Sofia Coppola's work.
You know, that's perfect. And at first I was thinking, okay, a line of dialogue. You don't think of her necessarily as a writer or a dialogue writer. And maybe that came from the original source novel, but it does describe exactly what it's almost like she took that as a model for here's how my movie should
exactly.
look as well. So you see maybe a perfect pairing of source material and filmmaker there very early on in her career.
Yeah, I just thought it was a very evocative line, and it was a line that jumped out just because I think it can be used to describe her approach to setting and character and perspective, because that's what makes Coppola, I think, such a distinctive director, is her intimacy and her obsession with really getting into the skin of her characters and really seeing everything through their eyes to the point where this isn't supposed to be a recreation of reality, but a recreation of almost somebody's memory of what happened. And so that line just really jumped out at me and I thought was just a really beautiful line too.
Yeah, good pick. All right, number two, I'm getting to my favorite Coppola film, Lost in Translation. Sorry to be so conventional by naming it that way, but it certainly offered the most moments to pick from for me, I thought. And I ended up landing in the same place as listener Jeff Milo, who left this voicemail.
Hey, Film Spotting, this is Jeff Milo from Ferndale, Michigan, calling about the Sofia Coppola scenes. I know a lot of people are going to tell you about Lost in Translation. I'm sure the obvious scenes, like the muffled whisper or maybe that quiet moment that they have in the hallway. But to me, the nexus of the film is the does it get easier scene. I can't say enough about it, particularly that it's a really fascinating study in body language from these two actors who are lying down and kind of barely moving. If you play the clip on the air, the regrettable thing is that the frequency of Bill Murray's blinking won't be audible, but the often remarked upon subtleties of his acting style are really concentrated so powerfully in this scene. And I think Johansson plays it great as well in terms of being kind of curious and attempting compassionate at the same time, but there's such a stunning sense for pacing. Like, this is how people talk when they're exhausted but can't fall asleep, or, you know, this is how people talk late into the night, you know, when it's quiet. But the sentiments that he shares about his life 30 years advanced from hers, and the way he kind of shows his wounds but sort of downplays those wounds at the same time because he doesn't want to scare her, he wants to encourage her. I don't know. I could go on. It's packed with subtext, and maybe you should just play the clip instead of me rambling.
What about marriage? Does that get easier?
That's hard. We used to have a lot of fun. Lydia would come with me when I made the movies, and we would laugh about it all. Now she doesn't want to leave the kids. And she doesn't need me to be there. The kids miss me, but they're fine. It gets a whole lot more complicated when you have kids.
Yeah, it's scary.
It's the most terrifying day of your life, the day the first one is born.
Yeah. Nobody ever tells you that.
Your life, as you know it, is gone. Never to return. But they learn how to walk and they learn how to talk, and you want to be with them. And they turn out to be the most delightful people you will ever meet in your life.
So this scene takes place, of course, after a long night of talking when Bill Murray's disaffected movie star and Scarlett Johansson's disenchanted young wife are drifting off to sleep. At that moment, she unloads this really what's a desperate question for her. Jeff's voicemail pretty much nails what makes the moment great, but another listener, Peterson Hill, he added a bit more on my Larson on Film Facebook page that I wanted to share. He wrote, "The way Coppola frames the scene is beautiful, with much of it occurring in that single shot from the bird's eye view. She captures the humanity and the secret longing that makes this her finest film." And rewatching Lost in Translation just a couple days ago, I remember hoping that that bird's eye view shot would sustain. And she does have to cut eventually, whether it was her aesthetic choice or because of something in the performances, to a more traditional side-by-side shot. But for that overhead view, because you get to see some of those performance gestures that Jeff was talking about, it's really a lovely moment. So that's my pick for my number two, Does It Get Easier, from Lost in Translation. Well, that brings us to our number one picks. Angelica, what did you end up going with there?
I went with Lost in Translation, partially because I rewatched it rather recently and was really struck by certain moments. And I'm going to highlight the ending between Bill Murray's character and Scarlett Johansson and the whole unheard whisper thing, because I think it sort of captures a lot of my issues and interest with Coppola at the same time.
Okay.
And I think she sometimes has an issue with mistaking opacity for complexity.
Ah.
And I think that comes across a lot with that one moment. And people's also obsession with figuring out, like, what he whispered in her ear, which, in my opinion, doesn't matter at this point.
Yeah, I would agree.
There's also something about their kiss that sort of throws me off now. And I think partially is because just how young Scarlett Johansson is. Mm. I mean, she was younger than I am right now. And so it sort of changes the tenor of the relationship for me.
Absolutely.
As a woman. So that ending sort of got under my skin, I think, in the wrong way.
Huh.
And so sometimes I feel Coppola's perspective, instead of seeming light and beautiful, can curdle.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because having rewatched it, I had the same reaction, how young Scarlett Johansson was. And also, it was much less platonic on this viewing than in my memory.
Same.
But the movie obviously has not changed. I have. I don't know if I've seen Lost in Translation since it first came out in, what, 03.
I agree. Same.
So,
yeah.
I'm at a different age. I have a daughter who is closer to Scarlett Johansson's age in that movie now. When I first saw it, I was probably, I'd have to do the math, closer to her age. You know what I mean? So you're seeing it almost from a peer's perspective to now maybe the Bill Murray perspective. And when I was younger, I remember admiring how platonic it was, how cool it was that that could be this relationship, this mentor relationship could be. And now I see that there was more going on there, at least through my current lens, than what I had thought initially. The kiss is part of that. I think in the scene that I picked, the way there's that one gesture towards her foot that, yes, ends in padding, but that's very intimate to go for someone's bare foot. And you may end it with a pat, like a fatherly pat. But the fact that you went there in the first, and I'm not saying this makes it a better or worse movie, that I like it more or less. It's just fascinating to me how I'm viewing it differently. And, you know, it sounds like you're on the fence a little bit about whether the unheard whisper is ultimately a positive thing or how much is actually there. But I think it does speak to this willingness to let Lost in Translation be whatever you want it to be, which is interesting in Coppola's career too, because we keep talking about how specific she is in her character's points of view. Yet this one stands a little bit apart, where we're not always sure what they're thinking. As intimate as the movie is, and as much as it captures that sense of dislocation, there's a lot left up to us.
Yes.
And the fact that it opened up other things to me on this reviewing makes it, it's why it's still my favorite film of hers.
Oh, I definitely agree. Rewatching it just a few days ago as well, I was struck by how romantic parts of it felt.
Sure.
And intimate in a way that crossed a line that I was just like, this could – I almost expected scenes to go differently, even though I was like, I know I've seen this movie.
Yeah.
It's not going to go in this direction. But you're right. We do bring a lot of ourselves to what we watch. And that totally affects our viewing and how we interpret things, even over the course of time. I definitely agree.
And I can't think of another film that I've experienced that so starkly as with this revisit of Lost in Translation. So despite all the love for Lost in Translation, it didn't land at my number one spot. I actually went for a scene from Marie Antoinette at number one. It's the shoes and cakes montage. I just love all the anachronistic music in this movie in general. You've got Susie and the Banshees, you've got The Cure, you've got New Order, and then you have Bow Wow's I Want Candy, which anchors this montage. Kirsten Dunst is queen here. She's playing dress up, all while indulging in cakes and champagne. So this movie was such a bold experiment, very controversial, not without its issues. We've already touched on it in our Beguiled review, but I can't help but admire what she went for here. This is maybe the starkest example of Coppola taking a massive story and looking at it through the narrowest of lenses. But when she captures that experience, that moment in that mood, when she does it so ecstatically as she does here, you know, what it would be like to have the whole world at your feet and the endless shoes to put them in, I find the experience exhilarating that she's able to do that. So I think that probably the shoes and cakes montage is my number one, because only Coppola would consider the story of Marie Antoinette and come up with a scene like this. So number one for me.
That's a really good number one pick. I actually really love that montage scene. Also, it's just so fun and buoyant and like and distinctive. And I think as much as I am usually a bit colder on Coppola, I do really appreciate how she really goes for, just really goes for it, even if I don't agree with what it happens to be a lot of times. And I think Marie Antoinette is a good example of that, because she does not care about historical reality. She's just creating this mood and presence and energy that feels very much like a young girl getting power she does not know what to do with.
So those are our five picks. Do you want to share a couple others that you considered? I have a few here. The Whisper was definitely in the running for me. The karaoke scene also from Lost in Translation. That's one where we just get, I think, that moment, that exact moment is captured so well that you're right there with them. Really, that whole night, that kind of bleary wandering through Tokyo night, I think she does well. And then I had one more that almost made the list. It's going back to the Virgin Suicides. There's this montage of the boys, the neighborhood boys, getting up the courage to call the Lisbon sisters, but they only communicate by playing records. And then they call them back. So this goes back and forth. A listener on Twitter, Hot Dog Thursday, suggested this one as well. It says, this is where the boys and the Lisbon girls communicate through records. It's a mix of joy, desire, melancholy, and mystery. And I think that captures that scene pretty well.
Yeah.
Did you have any others that you thought about?
I actually really do like that scene from The Virgin Suicides. Also because it just feels like so high school in a lot of ways.
Oh, totally.
The technology may change, but just rewatching it, I was just like, oh, this is so weird.
The awkwardness and yet the excitement of it. And then,
the sincerity, the earnestness.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's just, it was a little intense rewatching, partially because my 10-year high school reunion is this year.
Are you going?
Hell no. But I just, it made me think about high school and how I never want to return.
Yeah, better left in the past. Any other moments you considered?
I just wanted to highlight how struck I was rewatching Marie Antoinette. Because I was kind of cool on it the first time I saw it, which was around the time it came out, so I haven't seen it for a while. And it's so interesting watching it next to The Beguiled and see how much she's grown and is pushing herself in a really interesting direction as an actress. So I just wanted to highlight that. I think someone should write a piece about Sofia Coppola, Kirsten Dunst, and their collaborations together. Very rich collaborative experiences.
I think that someone should be you.
It probably will be.
We'll look for that. For now, though, that is the show. Thank you so much, Angelica, for doing this. It was fun once again. Hope to have you back for another rich topic. If you are interested in hearing Angelica previously on Film Spotting, where we did review Suicide Squad and shared our top five women comic book characters done right, you can find that at filmspotting.net in the archives. While you're there, why don't you vote in that Film Spotting poll we mentioned earlier, the best film of 2017 so far. Let us know which one you think it is. Also, if you haven't already, please do check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. We've got two other shows in our little family here, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both of those in Apple Podcasts or through your preferred podcast app. Out in limited release this weekend is The Beguiled. More people will get a chance to see it finally now. Also, limited release for The Big Sick, getting good reviews. And we had an interview, Adam did, with the star and co-screenwriter, Kumail Nanjiani. That is available at filmspotting.net. They just talked last week. That's The Big Sick. Out in wide release, Despicable Me 3, more Minions, The House with Amy Poehler and Will Ferrell, and then the Angelica Jade Bastien recommended Baby Driver from Edgar Wright. That's what Adam and I will review next week. Baby Driver, Angelica, will we be able to find your thoughts anywhere on the film? Are you reviewing it or writing about it? Or where can we find your stuff in general? Because you're always up to something interesting.
Well, in regards to Baby Driver, I did not write a straight review, but I did write a piece I'm very proud of about John Hamm as an actor. And I feel he usually coasts, but I was very, very impressed with his scuzzy, thwarted, somewhat sadistic take on a villain that would not be out of place in an old school 50s noir from Baby Driver.
All right. We'll check that out. Is that already?
Vulture.
It's at Vulture. So we'll link to that. Where can folks follow you? I know you're active on Twitter as...
Too active. I'm far too active on Twitter as Angelica Bastien. So just my first and my last name, and you'll find me. Beyond that, I am a contributing writer for Vulture. They get pretty much everything I write. So if you're looking for me, go to Vulture.
Awesome. Thanks again for being on. This was fun, and we'll have to do it again in the future. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board as well. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Now you threw me off there. Were you channeling who you said you were going to channel?
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't
recognize. Apparently she's just as scuzzy as fucking, like, I'm channeling her. Sorry. But I'm channeling.
Rewind that.
Oh God.
All right.
Just a side note that can be cut out.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm channeling Dorothy when she talks to Rose, which actually sounds a lot like because she's so annoyed.
Okay. All right.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.